some dynamics today.
Okay, so maybe for my own sake, we first make a schedule, what I would like to tell you. So first, why it is important. Then second, let's say basic mechanisms. And components. Oh yeah, oh, we are in the US, okay. okay, and maybe then I tell you something about cells. Small versus large. Okay, so maybe later more. Okay, so why is calcium dynamics important? There are different systems of transmitting information in an organism. There's the well-known central nervous system, which uses membrane voltage to code, transmit, and process information. Then there is using a whole complex of messengers. Those messengers are, for instance, hormones, but can be hormones. Yeah. But can be other chemical species too. And they are produced at a certain spot in the body and then transmitted by the blood system or the lymphoid system to another area in the body. And there they bind to cells, and when they bind, then they transmit a certain message. And for instance, a message, the organism has eaten something. So the pancreas should start to produce something. So this is a second system of transmitting information. And then inside the cell, the information has to transfer further to certain targets. So when a hormone has transmitted information towards a single cell, then it still needs to reach the very special target inside the cell. And for that purpose, so-called second messengers are used. So those are the guys picking up the mail at the door and then transmitting it through the offices in a house, for instance. And that's why they are called second messengers. So the message was brought by the primary messenger, and then second messengers take over.
And the door is the membrane.
The door is a membrane, exactly. Or you can be more precise, the door is a receptor sitting in the membrane. And calcium is probably the most important second messenger in animals and in plants, so it's used in plants too. And it's probably used inside cells as information carrier, as universal as electric current in the human society. And it's used in similar way, because the information is coded in amplitude and in frequency of calcium oscillations. So it's used like a radio AM or FM signal. So for instance, calcium is used during synaptic transmission when an action potential arrives at a presynaptic terminal, then calcium channels in the membrane open and calcium flows in from exterior space, increases intracellular calcium concentration, and that causes vesicle fusion and release of neurotransmitter. Then calcium is used, of course, in membrane voltage dynamics as one of the charge carriers, but it is used in neurons too to propagate intercellular waves, for instance, for communication between different spines on dendritic trees. Yeah, so there might be a spine receiving, spine of those small spherical extensions of neuronal dendrites, and a spine may receive a signal and then accumulate the signal, and then an intercellular calcium wave, so not membrane voltage, an intercellular calcium wave carried by the appropriate machinery communicates to to another spine. So it's even used in...
So where's the spine? Two separate spines? Can you draw
them? Yeah, spines are usually on dendrites. So they look like this. Is this curbus in English?
Pumpkin.
So this kind of pumpkin. So they look like this. Yeah, and spines may receive signals from other neurons by synapses. And then there's the intracellular calcium wave machinery in the spines and in the dendrite. And that may communicate a wave to...
That's one cell, right?
That's one cell.
It's
intra.
When you say inter and intra, it's difficult to
okay.
hear the distinction. So
yeah.
You
yeah.
said intra.
Intra.
Yeah, it sounded like it.
Yeah. So then, this is one example. Then,
are you going to discuss what is special about calcium and why it's used in stem cell
neurons? Simply, I don't know.
Oh.
Yeah. So probably it can only be understood if you look at the whole way for how the different ions are used. For instance, sodium is one of the most important charge carrier in membrane voltage dynamics. And it's probably going in and out in the largest amount during burst and things like that in larger amounts and calcium. So maybe this is the reason why it is not sodium. Yeah, but this is entering the realm of speculation.
I mean, I've asked the biologist that question. He answered me. This is not what he says, but he told me because it's doubling charge. And that's useful because the proteins all have, in the cell, mostly have negative branch charges.
Mm.
So it's a very easy interaction between the doubling charge.
Yeah, but magnesium, for instance, is almost as abundant in cells as calcium, but it's not used for the purpose. But I don't know. And so then in muscle contraction, for instance, the electrical signal arrives at the muscle cell, and then it is translated from a voltage signal at the cell membrane into an intracellular signal, which is again a rise of calcium concentration. And then this rise of calcium concentration is the order for the muscle cell to contract. Yeah? So this is the final step of signal transduction for muscle contraction. Then in the in pancreatic cells, the secretion of the stuff we need to digest our lunch is controlled by calcium too. So there again, the last part of the command line to the final action is a calcium signal. In the liver, the coordination of cell behavior, now we enter intercellular waves, is done by calcium signals now traveling through a few cells. Then on the uterus, local coordination of cell behavior is done by intercellular calcium waves. In glia population, the coordination of the behavior of small groups of glia is done by intercellular calcium waves, and so on and so on. So there are hundreds of applications. And this is just a very universally used messaging system. So, Now how it is done. Let's draw cell first. So this is to zero order approximation, the idea of a cell we need. This is a cell membrane, and then inside the cell there's a soup containing all kinds of stuff, ions, proteins, and whatsoever. And this is called the cytosol. And then embedded into the cytosol are cell organelles, and among the cell organelles are two which are important for us now, and one is the endoplasmic reticulum, abbreviated ER, and the other one are mitochondria. And the typical feature of mitochondria is that they got two membrane layers, and the inner membrane is folded like this. That's quite easy. So if you draw them, you can easily distinguish them from the endoplasmic reticulum. So the endoplasmic reticulum and the mitochondria are calcium storage compartments. The total calcium concentration inside the endoplasmic reticulum is between 2 and 4 orders of magnitude larger than in the cytosol. And it's not as extreme for the mitochondria. There, the numbers vary what the total concentration of calcium is in mitochondria, but probably the difference is not so big as in the ER.
Remember, but I don't remember what the number is. Outside them, in the cell, not in the compartment, the concentration is extremely low.
Yeah, the
calcium ions is really.
Yeah, I'll come to that in a second. So, before we discuss the concentration difference, I need to tell you about one other component of calcium dynamics which is rather important, and those are buffers. And buffers are all over the place and in the storage compartments too. And buffers are simply proteins which bind calcium. And they bind it according to a very simple kinetics. So the on rate of buffers is simply some kind of constant buffer concentration times calcium concentration, and off rate of buffer is simply proportional to the amount of buffer-bound calcium here, which is noted with capital B. And then if you write down the differential equation and ask for the stationary state, then the fraction of calcium bound to buffer, the amount, is proportional to the total concentration of buffer times the calcium concentration divided by the ratio of the on and off rates, K minus. Yeah, B total. B total.
On the left. Isn't that the bound?
This is a free. Okay, this should be. Yes, the amount of calcium bound buffer. So it's B total times calcium concentration divided by this ratio plus calcium concentration again. So and that means that buffers stabilize a certain calcium concentration, and that is the calcium concentration which is given by this dissociation constant. Yeah. So this is where they bind best or are most sensitive to changes in the concentration of free calcium. And this is the concentration they would like to stabilize.
What's the size of the ratio? They're roughly the same, right?
And this is now... No, I'll tell you in a second. I'll tell you in a second. So most of the calcium in each compartment is buffered. So between 95% and 99.9% of the calcium is buffered. Yeah. So only a small fraction of calcium in the cell is free calcium.
This holds both in outside the ER
and inside.
Inside.
Yes. And it holds for mitochondria too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for instance, membranes often act as buffers too. Yeah. So now the concentration of free calcium is determined by the buffers in each compartment. Yeah. That means buffers in the endoplasmic reticulum typically have a ratio here of this in the range of now let's say between 50 micromolar to then there another important one has 300 micromolar dissociation constant here, and then there are some in the millimolar range. Yeah, so those are typically buffers.
These are ratios.
Yes, but this is.
I'm sorry.
They got different units.
Right. It's a ratio, but it has.
Has a unit.
Similar things, but it has.
So, Martin, if it's not classified information, what is the number of the free calcium ions in a small cell? I remember something like 10 or.
Yes, and so this is. Now, in the endoplasmic reticulum, free ions are in the few hundred micromolar range, and in the cytosol, they are in the 100 nanomolar range. 100 nanomolar.
So
that depends. Now, if one number which is relevant.
One picogram is one cell, or 10 picogram. So if you multiply it, you get some numbers and it's half concentration.
Now, what is a relevant number is we will come later to the arrangement of channels on the membrane, and there. They are clustered, so there's something like a elemental cell, yeah, which is typically a volume occupied by one cluster, and there are about 10,000 calcium ions in one elemental cell. Yeah, so and this is a number important for modeling, for instance. So that means you can use Fick's law, at least for at least if you don't. If you don't look at microsecond time scales, yeah, but the diffusion coefficient of free calcium ions is that's still debated, but the values circulating in literature are between 200 and 300 micrometers squared per second. So on relevant time scales, simply the averaging by the Brownian motion guarantees you or provides you the validity of diffusional laws. The buffer.
Yeah, all of them.
After we heard from David yesterday that the discreteness is so important, yeah. You have, you said in special tests they have 10,000. So
we can talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know there is discreteness was important there because there were certain mechanisms amplifying discreteness incredibly. Yeah, so things at the far away or far in front, yeah, in the tail, were important. So nothing like this happens here. Yeah, there's stochasticity comes in by a different mechanism, but not by those numbers here. Yeah, not those. The buffers are in buffer concentrations are in the range of a tenth of micromolar. Yeah, so that means about yeah 200 to 1,000 times larger than free calcium. Yeah, total calcium is of course in the same range. Yeah, as a buffer. Yeah. Okay, so.
So why does the cell keep so much calcium around?
No, because in the cytosol, there come the presence of high calcium concentration is some kind of signal. Yeah, so you want to keep it controlled. Probably the.
And so you say that's still the important part of the signal, that you are able to release a huge amount of calcium.
Yeah, and that you are able to release it spatially controlled.
No, I understand.
Yeah.
But you need big stores. You want a little bit stuff around.
Yes. Now those statements are always relative.
Of course. And the buffers usually are homogeneously distributed, or they have some pattern of.
Inside the ER, they got some pattern of distribution, but in the cytosol, the proteins in solution in the cytosol are homogeneously distributed. But membranes, for instance, act as buffers too.
One more question. Yeah. If you have these polymers, is the interaction, for example, if some calcium is fine, the way that you rotate it, it seems as if it's independent. Calcium is combined to some protein here. Does it affect the probability of binding of the polymer which is nearby, or it's independent?
And for buffers, it is typically assumed that binding is non-cooperative. So that means there's no crosstalk between binding sites. And most cytosolic buffers don't have more than one binding site. No, I'm not completely sure, but there are certain buffers in the endoplasmic reticulum which can bind many calcium ions, but typically cytosolic buffers bind only one, I think, or maybe two calcium ions, but not many. Yeah. So, okay, so most of the calcium is buffered, and then if you consider the motion of a calcium ion or the dissipation of a calcium gradient in the cytosol, then buffering becomes important. Yeah, if you forget about any channel dynamics and just write down the equation for the behavior of free calcium in the cytosol, then it would be diffusion, and then it would be binding by buffers. So, and then binding by buffers and the release buffers can diffuse too, so it's a little bit more complicated. But the binding by buffers is very important for the spatial decrease of calcium concentration profiles of gradients. And if you increase the buffer concentration, you can localize concentrations, high concentrations of free calcium. Yeah, and you can decrease the halfway, the spatial constant for free calcium. And this is a nice experimental tool, for instance, since calcium acts on calcium channel itself, you can easily tune spatial coupling between calcium channels.
You said that this formula that find the calcium that's specially charged, so they can find calcium that has this W charge.
I'm not sure about the charge, are you? I don't know if buffers are especially charged.
But the proteins, most of them have negative charge.
Yes, but yeah, but they are. No, there's a so-called. There's a.
If you have more of them binded or not binded, it should affect the diffusion of the calcium ions.
Yeah, that's what I just said here. So the binding characteristic of buffers set the constant.
Yeah, what I mean is that the diffusion term should be.
I think he's going to show that.
Ah, you're going to include.
Now, what comes out is that release from a point should be proportional to. Let's see. I'm not sure. It's something like 1/1. So I know buffer k plus times. Yes. So I think the constant for the decay of calcium gradients would be something like the square root of the diffusion coefficient divided by k plus v total. Yeah. So the product of the binding onward binding constant and the total concentration of buffer increases the spatial gradients. Yeah.
That's using the equation as it is, right?
Yes.
This is using the equation as it is.
Yeah, forgetting about this term. Yeah.
Seems like there should be some modification to the equation due to the fact that if you have a different number, the diffusion of the calcium ions, unless the screening lens in the solution is very, very short, the diffusion constant of the calcium ions should be depend on the amount of buffer which are open or closed.
Do you mean because of the charges? First, the charges are homogeneously distributed, yeah, and then the Dewar length of the cytosol is in the range, I think, of 9 angstrom or something like that. So it's incredibly short because of the high ion concentration. Yeah, so all charges in the cytosol are very efficiently screened, and then the density, simply the density you need to hinder diffusion, is much larger. And the way buffers bind calcium, I think, is not by charge; it's by a so-called EF hand motif. So it's a certain calcium binding site in proteins. It's not simply by charge. I don't know. No, I don't think so. Okay, so now what we will do now is we will go on the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum now and see what's there.
So what percentages, how important are surfaces? The membrane is extremely important for compared to the stuff that's the bulk.
In buffering?
Yes.
No, the bulk is more important.
The bulk is more important.
For buffering. That might be different inside the endoplasmic reticulum, but I don't know the numbers there. So now this area is a view onto the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum. And inside this membrane, we got two types of molecules, which are the most important ones for calcium dynamics. And these are channels. And then Schurka pumps. This is not drawn to scale. Oh yeah, I forgot to tell you the way, the reason why I drew the endoplasmic reticulum like one thing up here and then tubes here is that it has it comes in different types. It comes as flat cisternae, yeah, with dimensions of in the micrometer range, so in the plane they are filling, or and with an inner height in the range of 50 to 100 nanometers. And then it comes at a system of tubes, and tubes got a diameter in the range of the inner height of 100 nanometers, and typical spacing of a few micrometers, so 1, 2, 4 micrometers. So and that would be, now we look on such a cisternae. Here, for instance, we can draw it on a tube too, but that's not important. So there are channels and pumps. And channels are the molecules made to release calcium from the endoplasmic reticulum, and pumps have the task
so
to...
this is the membrane of the ER, not the membrane of the cell.
Yes, this is the membrane of the ER, so... ER.
So the membrane of the ER is even...
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes. But they are so the typical size of a channel is it's 12 nanometers. So the tube is 10 times as thick as the size of a channel. Yeah. So there's enough space to put a few channels on the tube. So there are channels and pumps, and pumps transport calcium back into the endoplasmic reticulum. And the channel we will talk about, and I think the whole meeting will be about one channel type. There are essentially two, the reanidine receptor channel and then the IP3 receptor channel. And I think there's no speaker in the meeting specialized on reanidine receptor channels. So we will talk about mostly about the IP3 receptor channel. It will become obvious why it is called like this. And this channel is present in non-muscle cells. The reanidine receptor channel is typical for muscle cells, heart muscle, and other muscle. And in non-muscle cells, the IP3 receptor channel is more abundant. So now these channels are controlled by binding of ligands. And here, each of those four subunits is a receptor for certain ligands. And in the case of the IP3 receptor channel, it is IP3, which is inositol 1,4,5 trisphosphate and calcium. So we got a channel subunit. And this channel subunit got a binding site for IP3. So this is probably true because the binding site is identified. Yeah, it was found in by molecular biology methods. So what is observed is if the calcium concentration increases slightly in the cytosol, the opening probability of this channel increases.
This is the free calcium.
Yes. And what is observed too is if the concentration increases even more, the opening probability decreases again. So what is often said is there is another binding site on the subunit for calcium. And
now
if
is this circle here one of these little ones?
Yeah, this thing is a channel subunit, and these are four channel subunits.
So it's one of those four.
Yeah. So, and there are in the molecule forming this subunit, there are parts which could be calcium binding sites. Yeah, but it's not clearly mapped out yet that there is really a certain calcium binding sites causing this activation. But this is what is thought how it works. So calcium binds to the subunit 2. And then if both IPS3 and calcium are bound, the subunit is activated. So why does one sentence more. If this a minimal amount of subunits is activated, the channel opens. And there are different types, subtypes of IPS3 receptor channels. So this minimal amount is 2 or 3. Yeah. So for the type 2, for instance, if at least three subunits are activated, then the channel opens. That means if at least 3 subunits have IPS3 and calcium bound, then the channel opens. So now if the cytosolic calcium concentration goes up even more, the open probability decreases again. And that creates a dependence of open probability on calcium concentration, which became known as a bell-shaped curve. It's not symmetric. And one topic of current research is how does this inhibition process causing the decrease of the open probability at high calcium concentration work? And that's not clear. The binding site for an inhibitory calcium ion was not found, and then there's a possibility of so-called accessory proteins. That means calcium binds to a protein, then this protein binds to the IPS3 receptor, and then inhibition occurs. Yeah. But how the detailed mechanism is a topic of discussion. Maybe we hear something about that during the meeting.
This is the probability for what to open?
For the channel to open.
Just one channel.
One channel, yeah.
And you need 3 of them?
You need 3 of the subunits to be activated in order for the channel to open. Yeah.
So what does that have to do with this probability? That's what confuses me. Does this probability refer to all 4 subunits?
Yes.
Or to one subunit?
No, it refers.
I don't understand what this 3 subunits has to do with this.
Yes. So, if you go to this range here, where the open probability just kicks off, yeah, then it should be proportional to calcium concentration to the 3rd power. Yeah, because 3 calcium ions need to bind at the channel complex in order for the channel to open. And that means at three subunits, one calcium ion needs to bind.
Oh, because the chances of two binding on the same subunit are small?
And no, there are not two binding sites for calcium.
Just one?
Yes.
Can you view this as a filter in the sense that in this case, if one of the channels has a calcium, then the probability to bind to the second one is different. So that's why you guarantee that you have some kind of a filter of the fluctuations. So they bind often only three are binds, and in order for the three to bind, you have to average over all this conditional probability, and it's like a filter.
Sorry?
Is it true that they interact that the way that I
No. It depends on who you ask. And in the early studies, especially in one paper by Bjes Prozvani, one of the experimentalists, there's a very interesting sentence. If you assume what you just said, then this range here would be more precisely proportional to the third power of the calcium concentration divided by the sum of the dissociation constant of the binding site of the corresponding binding site plus again the third power of calcium concentration. So this special form comes from high cooperativity. High cooperativity means that if one calcium ion binds, the binding rate for the next ion increases incredibly. So, and Bjes Prozvani writes in his paper, he doesn't know experimental data where you can distinguish between this and this. No. The tail is dominated by inhibition.
Yeah.
You cannot go to the tail.
It doesn't describe. Neither is the tail.
They all go to one.
Yeah. So that's simply, that's how it is. So and you will find some models using this, and you will find models using this. Yeah. Typically it is assumed that calcium binding is not cooperative. Yeah.
Except for then you get the inhibition, which is something else.
Which is something else, yeah.
So does IP3 get used? I mean, does IP3 get, does it change or is it the same?
And IP3 is, I'll come to that, a little bit later. Okay.
The channel is actually a pump, right? It really gets.
No, an open channel and.
It's just open.
It's not against the
gravity.
Yes, yes. So an open channel just allows stuff to flow with a gradient. Okay, so maybe so much. Oh yeah. Now let's draw one more picture, and that means the open probability independence on IP3. And this is then simply something like this. So the open probability independence on IP3, and then around here. This concentration would correspond to the dissociation constant of the IP3 binding site. You know, it again has an on rate and an off rate, and the ratio of off and on rate is the dissociation constant. And then, depending on channel type, this would be described by something like the IP3 concentration divided by the dissociation constant of this binding site to the n's power, and n would be between 1 and 3, depending on channel type. Yeah. So this is how IP3 increases the open probability. And in many experiments, at least, IP3 is kept constant artificially. And in that way, you choose the fraction of channels, which then can be opened by the calcium dynamics. Yeah. Because binding of IP3 is a prerequisite for the channel to open. So that means IP3 is a nice tool to control the excitability of the system. Yeah, it's for the calcium dynamics. So now we got already two important parameters which physicists like and which can be controlled very easily: spatial coupling by the concentration of buffers, and the excitability by the concentration of IP3. So now let's talk about geometry. Well, let's first talk about production of IP3.
Yeah, we talked about inhibition.
Yeah, what I can tell you about inhibition is that it occurs.
So that's still, what you're saying, that's still not character.
No, actually, there's a little bit more to say about inhibition. So the time scales of activation are fast, yeah, in the range of tens of milliseconds. Inhibition is slower. Inhibition builds up within 2 to 4 seconds, and then the recovery from inhibition means, let's talk in the binding site picture, that the calcium ion bond at the inhibiting binding site needs to dissociate. And this is occurs on time scales between 5 and 10 seconds, more towards 5 than 10 seconds. Yeah. So that means inhibition plus recovery from inhibition is the longest time scale in the system, in the longest time scale of channel dynamics. And it's in the range of 10 seconds together. Yeah. Okay. And then typically during inhibition, more than one calcium ion binds to, so like an activation. So now we add a cell membrane here, and in the cell membrane, there is a receptor. Again, so let's draw it like this. And this the set of receptors which are able to produce IP3 is rather large. So receptors for hormones, for growth factors, for ATP, for instance, and more stuff. So, but ATP was mentioned already a few times during the meeting here, so let's assume ATP binds here. And then the receptor has a protein sitting on this cytosolic side, which is called a G protein. And when the ATP binds at the outer side, the G protein dissociates into two subunits, the alpha subunit and the beta gamma subunit. And then the G alpha subunit activates PLC, which is actually cytosolic, I think. And then a PLC catalyzes the breakdown of PIP2, what I do not know what it means, I just know the abbreviation, to IP3. Okay, so what is important here is that the amount of stuff binding at the outside of the cell determines how much IP3 is produced.
And PIP2
is on the cell membrane? Yes, PIP2 is on the cell membrane. It's membrane bound. And PLC, I think it's cytosolic. I'm not completely sure. Yeah, it's cytosolic. Okay. And then IP3 diffuses towards a store, and as we learned before, IP3 sets the dynamic regime of the system. That means it determines if the cell is excitable or if oscillations occur or something else. And in that way, via the IP3 concentration, the amount of ATP which has bound to the outside of the cell is translated into frequency. Yeah, so a constant signal is translated into frequency by the amount of IP3 which is produced by the stimulation. And then IP3 is degraded too by phosphodiesterases, I think. And that means on a time scale of about a minute, yeah. So that means if ATP dissociates from the receptor on the outside of the cell, IP3 disappears and the cell stops to oscillate. Yeah, but that is a tool here. The IP3 signaling pathway is a tool how a constant hormone signal is translated into frequencies inside the cell. I don't know why this membrane bound, but this pathway here leading to IP3 is only one of many inositol pathways.
It just looks like the cyclic AT1.
It's similar, yeah. But to determine the function and the position, or why the position of PIP2 is meaningful only from this pathway, would.
Basically, I was asking because I don't understand the PIP2 either.
Yeah. I don't know.
For some receptors on the membrane, it's known that there is long range interaction. That's how they can determine the concentrations, say, within over 5 volts. Sensitive reductions.
So the gene protein stays basically at the membrane.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Okay, so now we talk about geometry. So this is again a patch of ER membrane. So we are looking again on the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum. So the channels there are not distributed randomly and with an homogeneous probability, but they are arranged in clusters. So we got clusters of channels. Now each circle is a channel, not a subunit. And there is evidence, or there are results pointing towards that the channels within a cluster are densely packed. So they are as close to each other as they possibly can be. Yeah. Maybe. And the typical distance between clusters is 2 to 7 micrometers. Yeah, it's cell dependence, it depends on the location in the cell. For instance, the HeLa cells and some other cells, the cluster density is higher around the nucleus and falls off towards the cell membrane.
The size of the cluster,
yeah, and the number of channels in the cluster is, and I used to say between 5 and 25. Peter's favorite number right now is 10, and Ian Parker's favorite number right now is 40. But whatever, it's small.
What's the diameter of a single channel?
Sorry?
How big is the individual?
A diameter of 12 nanometers. Yes. So that means the area of a cluster is about in the order of let's say 30 times 12 squared, and that means the so it's around let's say 100 nanometers or something like that. Yeah, cluster radius.
Is it really moving around the membrane,
I don't know how much the clusters move. I know that degree of clustering is state dependent. So on the time scale of an hour, clustering increases. Yeah.
The distance between the cluster is about 10 times the size of the cluster.
Yes, at least 10 times. 100 times.
100 times or 10 times?
The setting was 200.
Yeah. It's 10 times. Mm-hmm. 10 times. Yeah. So it's 20 to 70 times. Yeah. 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 So there are different numbers. As Ian Parker, in his early papers, he gives 2 micrometers. In his later papers, larger numbers. Bootman, working with HeLa cells, gives this number here. So it's in that range. But whatever, the diffusion length of calcium in the endoplasmic reticulum is below 1 micrometer. Yeah? That means concentration profiles fall off to strongly on the length scales of cluster spacing. Yeah, so you got a concentration profile like this, and this would be the location of one cluster here. The next cluster is in this range here, where it has fallen off to, according to my simulations, to at least 1/30 of the value here. But it's probably more, so the 1/30 is the least. So this geometry and these values are the reason why stochastic behavior is important in calcium dynamics. You know, each cluster is strongly coupled within the cluster, but they are only between 5 and 20 channels taking part in the opening and closing game, yeah, because the number is reduced by not saturating IPC concentration.
If you say they're tightly coupled, that means when one channel opens, then you get more calcium.
Yes.
When you get more calcium, but the other channels open up too.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Open up the whole thing.
Yes.
But the holes don't communicate very well.
Yes. So the coupling within one cluster is strong because they are so close to each other, you know, and the concentration profile doesn't decay on the length scale of channel separation within a cluster. But the coupling between different clusters is very weak, you know, because the concentration profile decays a lot on this length scale. And that means you got a small or a lot of units consisting of 5 to 25 active elements behaving randomly, yeah, and they are only weakly coupled. And this is the major reason why random behavior and stochasticity is important in calcium dynamics. That's geometry and the number of channels per clusters and this amplitude here. Yeah, That means the opening of a single channel really does something which the other channels in the cluster feel. Yeah, they really feel it. Okay, so what now? Yeah, then maybe wave patterns. About waves, not so much. And Ian will talk about it. Yeah. So the basic stuff is set, I think. So there are in large cells you can observe waves, cells which are larger than the typical wavelengths. In small cells you see oscillations, and large is 1 millimeter over size. Yeah. Yeah, and what you see typically in small cells, the oscillations are not homogeneously, but they start at a certain point and then spread. Yeah, so probably the oscillations in small cells are waves, but this, the answer to this question would again depend on who you ask. I think so, other people might not. Yeah, but dictyostelium is highly buffered. Calcium in dictyostelium. So there's a very short diffusion length in dictyostelium. So that's why.
Why?
Yeah.
So what do we see in the conference we have?
Yeah,
on Sunday,
Colin Taylor will talk. And Colin Taylor is one of the few most important experimentalists working on the channel dynamics. Yeah. Yeah, and he started to look at what does the resting level of calcium do to the dynamics. Yeah, and this is a topic, the importance of which became obvious for me only in the last year or so too. And it's important because of these huge amplitudes. So you got a machinery which deals with peak amplitudes in the range of 100 to 200 micromolar. But the opening events are caused by concentration in the range of 40 to 100 nanomolar. Yeah? So you got here something which needs to be sensitive to concentrations, or needs somehow able to communicate via concentration values covering three orders of magnitude. Yeah. So Colin Taylor started to look at the range, what does the base level, the question, what does the base level to do? So the next speaker, I don't have the program here, and I cannot, now there will be Ian Parker on Monday or so. And
tomorrow is
Roderick. Oh yeah, okay. Coombs will talk about the most simple model you can think of, and what the idea of this model is. What Eberhard just said: if one channel opens, all of them open. Yeah, so it's a single threshold for the whole cluster, and forget about. And noise of the single channels, yeah, you apply a little bit of noise to the threshold, and then that's how you introduce your stochasticity. That's a basic idea of the model, and actually quite a lot comes out of this already, and he will talk about that. So you, Roderick, now you used to work on endoplasmic reticulum, so features of the endoplasmic reticulum. But I don't, has anybody got the program here? No. So then Ian Parker. Ian Parker and here in Irvine and the laboratory of Martin Bootmans in Cambridge are probably the two laboratories who did most of the work on the transition from local events, so that means only a single cluster fires and creates a so-called puff, and it's important vocabulary. So if a single cluster fires, that's a puff. Yeah. So Ian Parker did a lot of work on the transition from puffs to waves, and then which role. And he did magnificent experiments measuring single puffs, that means the opening of single clusters during waves. Because of the spatial separation, you still can do that. You can observe elementary events. Yes. And he will talk. Actually, he will talk on Monday. Yeah, imaging calcium microdomains. That means how you can image those very more small areas and the events there, and then how buffers influence the behavior of waves.
Maybe you should talk about just the existence of waves.
Right now, you mean?
Yeah. I mean, just that's mm-hmm. the elementary, isn't that the simplest phenomenon?
Yes. Well, maybe oscillations are more simple.
Right.
Yeah. So,
distinction.
Yeah. Okay, let me just, I will briefly go. So so the talk by Ian Parker will be maybe closest to physicists, to the thinking of physicists. Yeah?
That's Monday.
Coombs will provide the most simple model. Roderick talks about accessory proteins. Yeah, so if calcium binds directly to the channel, or if there are more proteins involved. Okay, and then Jim Lechleiter will talk too, but he was the first to measure complex wave patterns, so spirals and things like that inside cells. So he kind of set off the whole calcium wave business. He is talking on Monday, 2:30, and he will talk on calcium waves from worms to oocytes. So there are, he told me there are waves in C. elegans going through the whole animal, yeah, or parts of the animal, and he started to look at this, and he will talk about this. So those are intercellular waves then. You mean in the whole body?
Yeah, yeah. There are some disorder of hormones, then what you mentioned there, hormones, and then people can have shock of the high temperature or oscillation of the calcium.
Okay, so I wanted to tell about waves. So the intercellular medium with respect to calcium dynamics behaves essentially like an excitable medium.
Did you say inter or intra?
Intra.
The only talk will be about inter?
No, there will be.
The elegance is.
Yeah. Yeah, Andrew Charles will talk too, and he's an intercellular wave guy.
Intercellular.
Yeah, Intel.
Right.
Yes,
right.
That's
what I'm saying. That's
yeah.
The whole thing.
What is special about calcium waves? Yeah. So is it just another application of the Fitzy-Naguna model, or is there to be said more about it? And of course, myself, as somebody who entered the stochastic business, I would tell the stochasticity sets it apart from the Fitzy-Naguma model and all that. Yeah. So each fluctuation, the open of a single channel is in a cluster is supra threshold. Yeah. And in terms of an excitable medium, and that means things become quite different.
And if I think of Tixistilium, for example, you know, where I have cells which are at different positions, they also start a fire.
Yeah.
And you would argue they are random, it should also come in at some point.
So
the discreteness, just the discreteness of the firing event. So the sparseness of the firing size.
Yeah. Now the point here is you need spatial discreteness and random behavior. Yeah. If weak coupling, weak spatial coupling and random behavior. Yeah. If you got strong spatial coupling across this distance, yeah, the behavior would average.
Right.
Yeah.
So they increase the density of these things, and they were coupled
them. Yeah. Yeah. So, but because the coupling is only weak, it just doesn't average. You know, that's the point. And so there is a continuous regime if you got the case of small channel spacing, of small cluster spacing, and large enough IP3 concentration so that enough calcium comes out with each cluster opening, then you get a quasi continuous behavior, yeah.
And then the basic phenomenon is just the excitable Fitzhugh-Nagumo phenomenon, roughly speaking.
Yes, roughly speaking. But Jim Lechleiter did in 95 experiments where he cranked up mitochondria. That means he made mitochondria working harder and producing ADP, and that is accompanied by mitochondria taking up more calcium and releasing more calcium. Yeah, mitochondria act similar like buffers. So that means if the concentration of calcium in the cytosol goes up, they take up more. If the concentration goes down, they release until they reach again steady state conditions with the cytosol. Yeah. And out of these experiments came a theoretical phenomenon which is different from what you can see in the Fitzhugh-Nagumo model. That is, if you write down a model for the medium, including the mitochondria, and then you analyze waves and you get the dispersion relation, that means velocity, normal velocity, in dependence on wavelength, then this is highly non-trivial. It looks like this. So full lines are stable branches and dashed lines are unstable branches. So we got...
What is it in Fitzhugh-Nagumo?
In Fitzhugh-Nagumo, it is this. Yeah. What Lechleiter observed was if you crank up the mitochondria even more, then suddenly spirals disappear, but waves still exist. And that is highly non-trivial. Typically, if you got waves in an excitable system, then you got spirals. The parameter range where you do not have waves, not have spirals, but waves in an excitable medium is typically very, very small. Yeah.
What does that mean? I mean, you get waves, you have to do something. So is it darkened?
Yes, they are pacemakers. He measured before, 2 or 3 years before, he measured that there are pacemakers in those cells, but because spirals have the higher pattern frequency, as time goes on, spirals suppress wave pacemakers.
Okay.
Yeah.
They are pacemakers.
They are pacemakers. Yeah, but typically in large cells, spiral suppressor pacemakers.
Okay.
Yeah. So when he cranked up the mitochondrial activity, spirals disappeared, but waves still existed. Yeah, and that was strange. So then,
targets.
Yes, targets still existed. And then we did the model, and at low mitochondrial activity, we get this type of dispersion relations. Then at a certain
but we did the model. You mean now a continuum model?
Yes, yes. It's in a continuum regime. Yeah, it's exactly. It's in the continuous regime. Yeah, so that means rather high IP3 and low buffer concentration.
So yeah. The only thing we added was a memory effect.
Yes. There's some
you know,
kind
the
of.
The model that you did was some more it has more dynamics.
Yeah, the model includes. Maybe I should talk a little bit about model. Now the model includes the dynamics of a channel, yeah, and the circa pump, so release and uptake of calcium, and then uptake of calcium by mitochondria and release.
But all in some kind of coupled reaction diffusion.
Yes, all coupled reaction diffusion equation. So
the time scales are very different.
Not so much different. Yeah. So what then happened is that these two branches here collide.
When
you crank up the mitochondrial activity, that means mitochondria take up more calcium during a wave when calcium is high, and then when the wave has passed and it becomes low again, they release more because they have taken up more. Yeah. And then, so if you increase mitochondrial activity, those two branches here collide, and then at the bifurcation point, that's a transcritical bifurcation, and beyond that point, you have something like this. That means there's a gap in the dispersion relation. Yeah. And there's a range of periods or velocities, yeah, in dependence on the wavelengths, which is not allowed. Yeah. So of course I was tempted to say this is the first organic semiconductor, but yeah. It's not like that, you know. So and then what happens is spirals got an intrinsic period, which is only determined by the parameters of the system. Yeah. And if the spiral period enters this gap, you know, maybe comes from here and then enters this gap, spirals disappear. But waves with a longer period can still exist. And this is how the spirals disappear, and then the slower pacemakers, which were suppressed before, can take over. Yeah.
So that's the top branch?
That's the top branch.
How about the lower branch?
The lower branch, actually, the pulse form of the lower branch is it's a dip in a medium with a rather high calcium concentration. So it's a pulse looking like this, traveling in this direction. And this is for 1D. And it turned out that in 2D, those waves of this type shrink from the free ends. So they are not stable. And the waves have a transmodal instability, so the wavefront is unstable.
To 2D.
Yes,
so
2D.
That's the stability here, one.
That's 1D.
So
yeah.
They're actually not there.
They're actually not there.
Yes. So now you can observe them transiently, but only as transient phenomena. Yeah. And so this is actually a new theoretical phenomenon which came out of the continuous modeling of calcium dynamics. Yeah. And then the other thing you can do with waves in intracellular calcium dynamics would actually be waves in discrete systems, yeah, because you can you got discrete release sites, and if you tune to conditions where IP3 is high enough, yeah, so closed and continuous regime, and then you play around with buffers manipulating spatial coupling, then you can have waves in a discrete medium. And the theory for this was worked out during the last years for calcium 2 by, for instance, Igor Mitkov and John Pearson. John Pearson will give a talk too here in Los Alamos. And we are just about talking the experimentalists into doing it experimentally.
What do you mean by waves in they have no analog?
Now, waves in a discrete medium, for instance, can show a pinning and deep pinning transition. Now, I'm not completely sure what your question is. How they are distinguished?
It's related to yesterday's talk, right? No? In the widest sense. I mean,
in the widest sense.
Equation,
yeah.
Which was discrete, I mean, they were...
No. I don't understand what you mean by waves in a discrete system. And if you take a continuous system which has waves and you discretize it, and either the waves persist or they don't, but this is something else.
Yeah, this is this here. A discrete medium is a medium where the active elements are spatially discrete. Yeah.
If they're coupled, then you might get waves going through it, or you might not. And that might be related to the corresponding thing in the continuum, or
we don't understand the distinction.
What's the distinction you're making?
Between waves
and
the
discrete medium and the waves you've
been talking about. There's a difference between a discrete periodic medium and a discrete medium that has some quench randomness.
No,
there are all these differences, and there are waves that propagate through all kinds of systems. I don't understand what the distinction is that you're focusing on.
Now, for instance, the distinction between waves in the continuous medium and the discrete medium is this unpinning transitions. Yeah, if you look at a bistable discrete system, yeah. Two stable stationary states, and you have a line of active elements here, and a few of them are in one stationary state, yeah, so let's say it's something like this. And the other one are in the lower stationary state. Yeah, so this might be a concentration or something else. And then here there's a transition range between the activated area and the not activated area. Yeah, which occurs on maybe on the length scale of one spacing, or it may even occur on the length scale of a few spacing of active elements, yeah? And this interface may start to move or not, yeah? In a continuous medium, in a continuous bistable medium, the interface would only be stationary for one special set of parameters, yeah? But here there might be a parameter range where this interface is stationary and a parameter range where it moves in one or the other direction. Yeah. Yes. It's, yes. Yes.
It wouldn't be, I mean, the stuff that was in the last Fergie talk, you know, Lawrence English talked about, Cornell, about these discrete, these were wave systems, these were waves, not excitable waves, but they were just waves, and this is a discrete medium where you have a band gap. And you were able to excite these very strongly localized tones because of the discreteness. Discreteness and the weak damping was responsible for leading to this extreme localization of energy.
I'm sure,
but that was discreteness, right? It came in through the discreteness.
I'm sure this is wrong, but I mean, do you mean that if the you have a wave where the extent of the front is long compared to the spacing, that would what you would call continuous beam?
Yes.
It's the width of the wave front.
That would be one way to picture the continuous mode, yeah, the continuous regime. But you still can get pinning in this regime too.
Yeah.
It's not sufficient. It's not a sufficient condition.
Right.
Yeah. John Pearson is the expert for this. I don't have all the formulas in mind now describing the different transitions. But for instance, you can get the velocity may start as square root of d or proportional to d, depending on on.
I think it's not that the mechanism for wave propagation is different, but that in discrete media you get pinning effects.
Yes.
And those are sort of additional things which can control the selection and can control the behavior of the waves, but the wave mechanisms are not different, or not necessarily different.
Yes, so you know what is there to say more about those waves is, so from a physicist's point of view, I think the interesting stuff would be to look at waves in discrete media in this sense. And this is non-trivial. So this sets Carlson waves apart from the Fitzsimons-Nagumo. And then, of course, you can use the waves as a tool to do cell physiology. Yeah, and that is, for instance, what Patricia Camacho in San Antonio and Jim Lechleiter did, and I did some theoretical work on this, and we just got the Erwin Schrödinger Prize for that in Germany. So then, if you look at this more closely, if you look at the very features of the waves, more detail, periods, amplitude ratios, and so on, then you can figure out something about the cell. Yeah. So their patterns tell you something about cell physiology. I should have told it during the discussion if it is a field. You know, their analysis of pattern tells you something about the system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I think that's not so interesting right now. So that then goes into biological detail. Yeah, but you can do it. So it's not, the state of modeling is detailed enough and sophisticated enough that you can do it. Yeah. So what the system sets apart is randomness, this, discreteness, and this, and the dispersion gap from other pattern-forming systems.
Very nice.
Okay, thank you.